I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Well, welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. We have Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 5. NASDAQ Futures up 650. So in honor of Lou, did you truncated that intro?
A little bit.
Where the guy says, I only give 15 minutes of solid work a week, but I always bill 50 hours.
That's one of my favorite lines in that movie.
Yeah, yeah. What about the part where he says he...
For favorite scenes, at least.
What do you think about the part where he still bills 50 hours?
Oh, I doesn't surprise me a bit. They're probably working on a government contract.
God love him.
That's how that worked.
I texted you yesterday. I was going to... Axew, I don't know if your buddy's still around and doing what he was doing, your accountant friend, your tax guy friend.
Robert Rayola?
Yeah.
Mr. Rayola, he's on Twitter. I see him pop up on Twitter, once, twice a week.
I'd love to have somebody come out and explain to me, Lucy, all the intricacies of all these people that are getting these cabinet-level positions in their... Somebody making a ruling as to whether they can sell off their holdings and not pay taxes on them and stuff, and how that all works.
I do have a explanation of that on my blog.
Really?
Guess. Yeah.
What did you say?
Let's hear it.
It was me versus ChatGPT.
God.
I immediately after the election was kind of decided, started thinking, well, what's going to happen with these guys with enormous businesses, Ramaswamy, Musk. Everybody, you know, has got billions of dollars at stake, and privately, you know, what are these ethics concerns? And I immediately went to the Hake Paulson example, and it turns out that if you have a cabinet level position or something that's appointed, that's I don't know, if it's important and you're allowed to sell off at least some part of your assets, and they're pretty much tax free.
They're not really.
That's not putting them in a blind trust.
No.
That's sell off.
Okay. Well, I think you have to. And let me pull it up here for a second. It says the requirement is. It says the reason he was able to. Was Section 1043 of the Internal Revenue Code. A government official can defer capital gains taxes on assets they are required to divest to comply with ethics regulations, provided they reinvest in qualified replacement assets such as broad-based mutual funds, government bonds, or diversified exchange-traded funds. The law's goal is to allow high-level appointees to sell assets that could create conflicts of interest without the financial disincentive of significant tax burdens. It gave the Hank Paulson case. He had to divest his stake in Goldman Sachs to avoid any conflict of interest, given that the Treasury Department's regulatory role over financial institutions. And
he still worked for Goldman.
I don't think these guys are not being appointed to cabinet positions.
That was the That was the example of when, I mean, that's what I would lobby for if I was one of them.
Lou, is that a, see, you know, you're gonna slide on the side of your guys here. It is not a cabinet position. It is a cabinet level position.
Well, that'll, so I'm acting like a lawyer now, and I'm just saying, is it a cabinet position?
It's a cabinet level position.
I'm pretty sure I ask
specifically in the case of Elon Musk, and what did it say here? Key positions that could qualify for tax deferral: cabinet secretary, senior advisor or special envoy, and a White House position, serving as an advisor in the White House on technology or economic policy.
The head of the SEC?
That definitely
is a cabinet.
Oh, that would be a cabinet level position. I don't think this commission is going to be a cabinet level position.
The chief of staff, the head of the budget, well, office of the budget. That's not a cabinet. But there's probably, how many cabinet positions are there? Like 12? I bet there's 25 cabinet level positions.
I think that's probably right. But I don't think what these guys are doing is going to be one of them.
Okay, now who we have all kinds of good stuff to talk about, but who the hell is going to be the moral judge of these people?
Nobody. There are no moral judges. You mean the legal? Who's going to make the determination?
If there is somebody, by the way, that they have yet to appoint yet. There's someone. Greg, find this out. Somebody in the chain gets to rule on whether you get to do this. So. Your stack, and
I think you need to be appointed, and then
there's a person who makes this call.
They have to be confirmed.
I know.
There's the White House. My recollection is that the White House has an office of legal counsel that is set up to assess with an ethics
right
that is set up to assess exactly this
right,
and they will.
Okay, who's gonna? We're scouring local 12 for the guy in this administration. Who the hell's gonna tell these guys what to do morally?
Well, I mean, I don't know who's gonna tell them to do what to do morally. We're talking legally.
Legal, it's somebody's call.
So if
they're confirmed, then it's okay. If they're not confirmed,
okay. What I'm saying is. I saved it. Now I don't have it. But there is a person that the White House is going to appoint that essentially is the ethics person regarding all this stuff.
Right. I think it's part of the White House Office of Legal Counsel, and I think they have an ethics group that does that. Other than that, there is a federal legal ethics authority or ethics authority that rules on these kinds of conflicts of interest, and they'll make a call.
Well, because like with. The reason why I know something about this is the late Alger B. Duke Chapman, who was the chairman of the CBOE, nice guy, but to say he was connected into the guys was an understatement, Lou. He went to Fordham. He played football. Had to get a fake knee because of that. He was Arthur Levitt's roommate in law school, who was a former chairman of the SEC.
He had to get confirmed, though.
He was confirmed as the chairman of the SEC.
And, right.
And somebody said he could sell all his Donaldson, Lufkin, and JetRed stock. And it doesn't say no taxes. It said you can like indefinitely defer them, whatever the hell that means. I have no idea what that means. You can...
It's like a 1031. If you swap into, what did it say, a qualified... You know, ETF or something that's replaced.
Well, who is it? I mean, but this is part of the deal. Remember, again, he didn't last very long. But who's what was he? Bush's guy? He was the head of Chesapeake. Was the Chesapeake in Ohio? Became the Chesapeake system.
Qualified the replacement guy? Assets.
He got to sell his stock in the Chesapeake system. As a matter of fact, Duke's dad took some job with government, okay, and he was the head of, remember the guys, what was their name? CCB, Capital Cities Broadcast, and they bought ABC?
I vaguely remember this.
Well, you know the story there, when they bought ABC, and they said, we were in kind of a recession, and Why would you pay so much money for ABC? ABC had a fully depreciated whole block in Manhattan. The real estate was worth more than they paid for the firm.
Yeah.
But anyway, he was the chairman of CCB. And when he got the government job, he resigned his position, and he ended up, he sold his stock, got the deal, but like 3 or 4 years later, his stock had like quadrupled. So it was like the worst deal he ever made. But at least he didn't have to pay tax on it. But I'm saying if these guys for a second think they're going to let, after giving Musk $9 billion from government, now they're going to let him sell his stock without any taxes. Lou, I think enough's enough, buddy.
He's not going to do that. He and Ramaswamy are, I don't believe, are going to be appointed to cabinet level positions.
Well, they just were.
Doesn't that involve confirmation?
They didn't
go before.
No, they're not going to be confirmed.
They're being.
I don't think they are.
He hasn't appointed.
Let's put it this way: it's indeterminate at this point. We'll see.
All right.
If it was part of the cabinet,
if they have to be confirmed, if they fall under that rubric, then they'll have to get a legal opinion as to whether they have to, what they have to divest and what they have to divorce themselves from. I'm pretty sure that it's not in the national interest to have Elon Musk withdraw from SpaceX. I'm pretty sure that it's not in the national interest to have him shut down his involvement with his companies. But in any event, I don't see that as much of an issue for those two guys.
So now we have part-time firers?
Part-time what?
Firers? Manhattan Project? On canning people in Washington?
I mean, they're gonna advise. You know, he's bringing them in for their expertise in management and leadership, and saying, I want, you know, you guys deal with the government, especially Musk. You guys deal with the government on a regular basis. Show us where we can be more efficient.
Have been to run something called the Department of Government Efficiency, to run it, not advise, or to run it.
I don't know what that means.
Well, it means that their name's going to be on the door. They'll be expected to be there, I guess.
How do you know that?
Well, they just created a new agency and put two guys in charge of it. I mean,
do you have a job description for them?
No. I'm saying it sounds like it's a job.
Well, it sounds like they're not going to get paid. Number one, it sounds like it's an advisory role. That, as I said, as Greg noted, is unlikely to have to face a confirmation battle. So I'm not really concerned about these guys. For one thing, it's not like Elon Musk is going to come out and say, well, I pretty much think we need to move the entire government operation to, you know, my company. I don't think he's going to do that. Or Ramaswamy will do that. I think it's going to be, you know, here are obvious targets for waste. Here are obvious targets for overspending. Here are obvious targets where you can remove people. Yeah, they'll put that out there, and then, you know, we'll see what the executive branch will do. It'll do what it can within its power without having to go to Congress, and when it needs to go to Congress, it'll do that.
I'm just concerned, Lou, that we all this stuff has been designed to. We all know there's conflicts of interest. I mean, Paulson could sell his Goldman Sachs stock, but he was still Goldman Sachs, if you ask me, because look at the deal he made with them when he was in that office regarding, what was the firm? They gave the other firm the money so they could pass it right through to, was it Merrill Lynch? Or somewhere they could pass it right through to Goldman? Anyway, but I don't know of anybody who right now is more got his nose up the ass of government than Elon Musk. Where is the any semblance of separation here?
Supposed to be in Congress.
I'm not really concerned about that because we should see a fair amount of transparency on this. I'm
willing to wait and see.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like he's going to be able to steer business to himself. That's not what he's doing. Why? Because that's not the role of the commission. He's talking about eliminating government waste and government inefficiency. I'm pretty sure he would prefer to have less contact with government rather than more, at least at this stage. You know, Elon Musk does not need to sell his services to the government. The government is begging for Elon Musk to come help it out. NASA couldn't run without Elon Musk right now. In case you hadn't noticed, his rockets are the only ones that are working. And so I don't think he's out there. It's not going to be an opportunity for him to solicit business. He doesn't have to.
We have a different view of the man, but that's okay. Let's see what happens.
We'll see what happens. I mean, the country voted for a big experiment now, and we'll see how it plays out. I wanted to open up with something a little more definitive where we actually know what's being proposed. Have you, and in light of your discussion about the Bears yesterday and how awful they are,
I was going to ask you about that.
And all this, I'm not going to talk about Chicago Bears. I'm going to talk about the United Kingdom. Do you know that the UK is now about to enact a position of a sports regulator? And this comes out as opposed to
no regulation, what we have right now going on.
It's something called a football governance bill. And they are going to have a government official, probably surrounded by whatever bureaucracy she can create or he can create.
10,000 people, a building, desks, each HR department, the whole bit.
A government official who is going to regulate the ability of their soccer teams to do things like build new stadiums, payroll, and diversity and inclusion.
Oh, God.
And so it, imagine.
There's not much diversity, though. What?
In British
uh-oh.
Soccer?
Uh-oh.
Oh, no. Have you watched Premier League soccer lately?
I mean,
the teams are tremendously diverse.
Well, let's just say there's a lot of different races, but here there would not be, and that would
in terms of actually running the organizations.
That's
what I'm saying. So now you've got this regulator who's going to come in, and rather than letting the market say, okay, here's what teams can pay, and here's what the payroll is, and the clubs regulate them, their organization regulates themselves. The regulator is going to come in and say, I don't think you're paying this guy enough.
Well, who knows? I mean, who knows what they're going to say? But
that's what the statute that they've enacted over there. That's what the statute gives this regulator the power to do. It's going to come in and whatever this person is, it's going to come in to basically discuss, ticket prices. Funding between the leagues and the clubs, how they allocate, how the leagues allocate the money going out to the various clubs. So I assume if we ever were stupid enough to do something like this in the United States, we would see, some federal agency coming in and goes, I don't like that salary cap this year. Or I think the deal you've cut with the television stations is too lucrative. Or by the way, Chicago Bears, you stink. So you're entitled to more money. I mean, it's crazy. It's done in response to two things. Apparently, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, the Premier League, a number of the top Premier League clubs were talking about setting up a European Super League. Very, very much, Tom, like the college football teams or football clubs are talking about setting up, but they were going to set up a European-wide Super League that would play across Europe, and would set up regular schedules rather than an English Premier League where you just have English clubs playing. These guys would be playing, you know, Germany.
They have the Champions League.
Well, they do, and that was in part the result of this. But they said, you know, we can make a hell of a lot more money if we just do this full time, and we set this league up full time rather than playing in our individual national leagues, and then, you know, putting out the UEFA Championship. So this started to gain ground in the UK, and the government got upset because it looked like, oh my God, we're gonna have our top clubs and they're not gonna be playing here anymore. They're gonna be playing, you know, against Barcelona. Anyway, this upset people in government, and so they decided they were gonna set up some mechanism to regulate their soccer teams, and the immediate reaction of all the, you know, the fans in the UK is, well, this will be the end. The government managing our football program will be the end of soccer in the UK, at least in terms, because we'll be back playing American level soccer.
I don't know why I'm pushing back on my best buddy Lou here today, but push back on that a little bit, Lou, because sometimes, I mean, I have the same discussion with Hal all the time, and Hal, first of all, Hal, I think, has zero idea. Yeah, he does. About how much I actually agree with him and just about everything he says. Nobody, it's like people accuse me of not liking the free market when I trade on the trading floor for 20 years. Or people thinking I don't like a free economy when I came out of the Chicago school and absolutely loved Milton Friedman, and that was the guy I was all about. The only thing I've learned, Lou, is that once the government does one thing, you should know, I don't know, I remember, what was the Asian statesman or whoever said, no man can do just one thing. Once the government does something, okay, there's going to be some kind of a follow-up. They're going to make a monopoly. They're going to allow a monopoly. They're going to let some weird crap happen. And all of a sudden, something needs to be fixed, probably because they're the ones who screwed up in the first place or allowed it to happen. Now, I look at right now here, what I want... a 5,000-person building in Washington handling sports. No. I mean, you know, I agree with you on that. But this mess of where college is going under the guise of being, Catholic charities or nonprofit, I got a problem with that.
Did you see Trump's thing about getting rid of the endowments?
Well, there's a thought.
Real fired up the other day instead of saying...
But that's... Let me go on the sports part, because that's another whole conversation. But the idea that Major League Baseball still has an antitrust exemption and somebody can't leave the minor leagues for 5 years, or the idea that if the Bears get a hair up their behind and go somewhere else, that Chicago can't just start up a new team and join the league unless 30 people decide to vote them in, or that is so... it is so monopolistic, so anti-American. I can't go there. I mean, I know the fans love it. We get to draft guys. What if somebody had to draft their kid to be in an accounting place or a law firm? I mean, the whole idea of the way this has moved down the road without a regulator. I go to Notre Dame. I walk into the church. I look around and I go, okay, this is like the little church in the burbs in Nebraska. We don't tax these people, separation of church and state. I look at 80,000 people in a place paying $100 for a ticket, and the state of Indiana doesn't get their amusement tax there. I go, wait a minute, something's wrong here. I mean, I'm just saying somebody needs to take somebody. Who the hell is somebody would be? Can we resurrect Solomon? I don't know if I want anybody looking at it, Lou, but something has to happen. How's that for a definitive non-statement from a non-attorney?
Well, and so it... I think what you're seeing with the UK is sort of a classic socialist government, you know, which is what they are, a classic socialist government response, which is, you know, we're going to come in, and there was a concern expressed by people when one of their football clubs folded, and they were, you know, a bunch of people stood up and said, you know, these football clubs are the backbone of our community, they're locally important, they provide a huge psychic benefit to the population. You know, we're big on psychic benefits. And so it's unfair, and it causes anguish when one of these clubs folds up. And it's going to cause anguish if Wembley Stadium no longer hosts Premier League games, but only a
but it will. People games. Are like that. They love the stuff.
Well, it's just the people are upset about the fact that they could lose identification with their club, and the government comes in and says, "Okay, well, we're gonna try to fix that." And rather than saying, "Look, we're gonna make it economically, you know, impossible for you to move to an organization like this," which they could do easily with a quick change in their tax code, they come in and say, "We're gonna regulate all of your finances," and you know, to a certain extent, we do that anyway. You know, the National Football League doesn't exist. Neither does the NHL or even, I think, Major League Baseball in its current form doesn't exist without having to do some legal gyrations to get their labor agreements written in such a way that they are a collective employer group as a collective bargaining entity, and that allows them to collude on the wages and compensation. But we don't have that kind of intrusiveness, and so
yeah, we do. Oakland leaves Oakland. Oakland says, "Okay, we'll cut a deal, and somebody else wants to come here and start a football team." Oh no, they can't get in. What's that all about?
Well, what do you mean they can't get in?
They can't get in the NFL.
Well, the NFL, but the NFL is a private business entity.
Okay.
All right, and so.
But I get to join.
This, of course, is the problem that the Brits have too. The Premier League, these are private business operations, and so what they've done with this football regulator position or entity is they're saying, "We are not going to allow you to function as a private business entity." Yeah, that's effectively what this regulator is going to do. We're not going to allow you to set ticket prices or whatever.
Well, what's the difference between the NFL and the restaurant group of Chicago having 100 people in there, and they'll never let in 101? What's the difference?
Well, is the restaurant group in Chicago collectively bargained? I don't think so.
But I mean, they were a monopoly before they could have collective bargain. That's what I'm talking, right?
Yeah. Well, yes, it's a monopoly. I mean, there's no question that the NFL operates as a business monopoly.
But I'm not big on monopolies. What I'm saying. Anybody who doesn't, I mean, the opposite of all the problems that are with socialism are the problems with,
well, sure,
monopoly.
And if you go in and this is a trade off, obviously. If you go in and tell the NFL you are no longer a monopoly, within 5 years you don't have a football club in Green Bay, you probably don't have football clubs in Minneapolis or Kansas City.
Why do you say that?
Because those markets are tiny, and you know, people don't want to live in Minneapolis. They'd rather live in South Beach.
I'm saying the point being is they. You can't enter the club. I don't have a problem with the league having a league, and sharing TV revenues and stuff.
I'm just saying this is, you know, the pendulum swings. Unfortunately, there does not. If you adopt a market solution, if you don't allow the collusion, you end up with something that doesn't look like the NFL.
Well, so what? I mean, let's go to break.
That's fine. If that's what you want. You'll end up with teams in New York and LA, Miami and other, you know, nice places to live with large markets, and you know, Green Bay, Minneapolis, maybe Detroit.
Why wouldn't when 70% of the money comes from the TV contract, why would somebody leave Green Bay? I mean, I could see
because Green Bay doesn't have a big television audience.
You know, okay.
The Packers.
We got to go to break here, but the thing that bothers me the most, as you know, constantly, because Chicago don't have any money, or the Bears, they couldn't be putting a noose around the gonads of the city and to get a stadium. The extortion is, if we leave, the NFL will not give you another team, and you can't start one on your own, so screw you. That I have a problem with.
I'm not convinced. Well, maybe in Chicago, but I'm not convinced that's true. The NFL would look at Chicago much the way they looked at LA. They would say, we have to move another team in there because of the market size.
Okay.
Chicago's a huge market.
That's part of the. I mean, Oakland's not going to get another team.
No, Oakland's a disaster area economically.
Okay, S&P futures up 7, NASDAQ futures up 18. Be right back.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
I'm an American. You're sick.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Owl. Greg Pappas on the board. We have S&P futures up 6, NASDAQ futures up 13. We had Cisco came out with good earnings, but the stock is down a little bit. Out of $1.68, trading $57.60, so not horrible there. Disney is another one that was, let me find Disney up here. I know they are here. Disney is up 8, so that's good. And Disney came out with pretty good earnings, so everybody's kind of moving to the upside here since the election. Obviously, we are moving that direction. I don't know what exactly. If we had been down and people liked the change, I get it, but we were flying up into the election, even when nobody knew who was going to win. So it just seemed like all we do is go up. Over in Europe, DAX up 245. And the guys has been down, but now they're bouncing back today pretty heavy. That's 1.3%. FTSE up 38, 0.5%. CAC around up 78. That's a full 1%. I don't know why the headline says Europe closes lower. It sure as hell looks like they're up to me. Asia, Nikkei down 185.5%. Hang Seng down another 387, another 2%. I think these guys, great. These guys top 21,000. Now they're 19.4. Shanghai down 59, another 1.7%. We come back from break. I want to touch with Lou a little bit, even though I'm sure he's got his own stuff to talk about. How far down can China go here before it affects us? I still think we're pretty strung into that place somehow. Yesterday, the Dow was up 47, S&P up 1. NASDAQ down 50, so pretty much an inside day yesterday. Bonds down 1 basis point, but still up to 4.44. They were up pretty strong yesterday. I say bonds, I mean the 10-year rate itself. The Bund down 1 penny, 2.337. Japan up 2 basis points, 1.07. These guys have moved from 0.9 to 1.07 in probably 3 weeks. Doesn't seem like much. It's only 1%, but for them, that's a big move. Oil up 34 cents, still in the middle of the range, 68.77. Brent up 32 cents, 72.60. Natural gas down 3 cents, 2.94. RBOB unchanged, 196. Gold, we've got gold down 25 bucks, 25.61. They're down $200 now in a couple of weeks. Silver down 58 cents, 30.07. Copper down 6 cents, 4.02. And we have the foreign exchange, which has caused a lot of this. The euro is down to 105.4. That's amazing how strong the dollar has been here. British pound's hanging in there better, but still down a little bit, 126.7. And the Japanese, the yen is 156 to the dollar now. It was 143. So that's a 10%, Greg, drop in the value of the yen. Crypto, however, has been the lion in this whole mess. Up 639, 91,201 for Bitcoin. Not sure about that. But then again, it keeps going up. What do you have for us, traffic, weather, sports?
Good morning, everyone. 6:40 a.m. here in Chicago. It is 51 degrees, cloudy, passing showers today, high of 54. Phoenix 51, it's right now 76 today, high probably 82. Traffic inbound Kennedy from Montrose 23 minutes, Edens from Lake Cook 43 minutes, Eisenhower from Wolf 50 minutes, Ryan from 95th 30 minutes, and Stevenson from 294 in is 38 minutes. Bulls beat the Knicks by one. That was 124 to 123. Suns lose at Kings. That was a blowout, 104-127. And tonight we got the Commanders at Eagles. Phillies favored by four. That's all I got, Chief. Back to you guys.
So, Lou, regarding the... I mean, I'm just looking for a little bit of truth in this mess. In the sense that why can't somebody... And sometimes I think that, well, we try and do it on the show. We think if we present the truth to people, their own decisions will be better. We're not going to try and tell people how to think, but their own decisions will be better. I mean, how many people in Chicago would have a different view of the Bears if you put Soldier Field on the front page of the paper showing my age, and somebody put down how much the Bears made per year and how much the rent has been per year over the last 20 years, and the four and five people that have the biggest contracts at Soldier Field, cleaning the bathrooms, all those kinds of things, and how much they made over the last 20 years, and how the people, you and me, still own a boatload on the damn place, probably almost as much as when it was built. Now they want another place? I mean, if somebody actually reads that, don't you think their view might just be a little bit different? But nobody even says it, Lou.
Well, okay, so I agree with you. I'm a big fan of transparency in these financial transactions involving stadiums and sports clubs, and so I don't understand why the Trib or the Sun Times is not out there just saying, look, we're not going to take a position on whether the Bears need a new stadium. But here are the numbers. Here's what it looks like, and let the chips fall, you know, where they may. But I think, in addition to those kinds of calculations, you have a non-monetary value to having a professional sports team in your city, and the, you know, that would have to get factored in too.
I would agree.
You know, and so fine. Now, here's what it actually costs us to have the Chicago Bears in the city. Here's the tax revenue we get from Bears games. Here's the, you know, revenue we get from the opposing players, you know, wages being taxed here in Chicago when they come in. Here's how much you know, tourism brings in, vice the cost, you know, that we're paying on the stadium, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, that'd be great. Well, places where they did that, they did, you know, here's the funny thing. In places where they've done that, that I'm aware of, like Buffalo, you know, the Bills got a brand new stadium leveraged by the state. Those numbers were all out there. Everybody looked at them and went, yeah, okay, well, the state's going to pay, you know, X gazillion dollars for this club, to have a new home. Yeah, we'll go with it.
Well, I mean, not everybody would do that, but you know, it's so weird. I mean, when you do your law work, you went to Duke, you went to Air Force Academy. You don't just forget the side of the equation that you don't like, right? I don't think you do that at all. I mean, I've known you a long time. I don't do that either. Okay, you're going to have some tourism. People are going to come in and watch the Bear games. Okay, I know 40 people that for years have gone out of the city one weekend for a Cubs series or a Bear series or a Bear game to Detroit. Now, are we going to subtract the money that these guys spend in Detroit for the weekend they would normally have spent here? Do we get to or is it all just people coming this way, nobody going the other way?
I can't answer that in terms of accounting. I mean we. Yeah, were they going to spend the equivalent amount of money in Chicago that they spend in Detroit on that weekend?
Well, I don't know. My point is, we're all about look at the bars around Wrigley are packed. Okay, are they packed with Chicago people? Would they normally be in a bar by me or a bar on the South Side? What is it additional cash or is it just displaced cash?
Right. Well, I mean, these are more you know, methodological questions rather than should we be putting this information out there.
Yeah, I agree.
Once the numbers come out, you got a target to shoot at, and you can say, okay, this number doesn't make sense. This number does. This number's too big. This number doesn't account for this. You know, that's fine. I think your initial point, should there be that kind of transparency in the financials, I'm all in favor of
it. Well, it comes down to, Lou, I mean, there's nothing wrong with,
you know,
what...
Could the city go to the Bears and say, you know what, we're going to help you with this stadium, but to provide us with a basis so we go to our electorate and say this is a responsible government action, we need you to put your financial... your financials out on the web to look at for last year.
If I don't have a problem with the city helping the Bears out for Soldier Field, okay, I don't think the Bears are capable, or anybody is, of condemning the property, whatever you have to do, all this kind of crap that a city has to do for a stadium, and of course they use it for other stuff. But now my only issue is why wasn't the rent $20 million and not $6 million? Over that period of time, or why didn't it go up at all? I mean, why is the place? Why didn't they even cover part of the loan part? I mean, the White Sox are paying $1 million or some number, and yet when I go downstairs for a drink, I'm paying to pay off the Sox stadium loan. What's that all about? I mean, if the new stadium, if you told the Bears you want us to spend $3 billion, somebody, okay, looks to me, we'll give you a good rate. 7%. The rent's $210 million a year. I got no problem with it, Lou. None whatsoever. Don't tell me the rent's 5 or 10.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not, as I said, I think the transparency would be very helpful. One of the things, but again, we have to account for non-economic benefits, but I mean that would be something factored in. I have no problem with that. I think one of the things that makes the NFL such an interesting topic of discussion is, and any major sports league, is the finances of the clubs are basically opaque. The only club that we get to see how the financial standing is doing is Green Bay, because they're publicly owned. So we see their numbers every year, and from that we try to extrapolate what's happening with some of the other clubs. I would prefer, but maybe the McCaskies are not in this position. I would prefer the owners of the club to basically say, we're going to self-finance the stadium, and maybe that's going to be more of a possibility. You know, the NFL has opened up to investment by venture capital groups. Not by individuals, but by groups, and for financing. So maybe now it's fair that we go to the McCaskies and say, "Look, you used to be tied strictly to family or individual financing. Now you can go out and get venture capital financing. You can bring people on as owners to finance the stadium. And if you want the stadium badly enough, that's what we want you
to do." There isn't enough venture capitalists on earth that's going to pay and give somebody $3 billion for $10 million a year in rent.
I agree, and that would be, that would be something else that would have to change.
Hey, can I shift gears on you a little bit regarding? We can argue about this like for the next 10 years if we're still doing this.
Well, I got another topic. I'm sure you'd love to discuss.
Well, can you answer me this one though? This China situation. They still are. Hold an awful lot of our debt. We still have a lot of companies that have not been able to get out of there yet, even if they're trying. We have companies that can't really leave because the people they supply are there. How much heat can we put on them? I'm not saying we shouldn't. I'm just saying, economically, how much heat can we put on them before it has a backlash money-wise here?
I can't answer that because I don't know what the tolerance level of the Chinese leadership is. But I think the thing we're worried about, and it's the same thing we've got concerns about with Russia. The thing we are worried about is the transition. We don't know where the transition point for them from soft power, the economic power, to hard power, the military power, is. At some point, if we try to leverage our ability to damage their economy, at some point they will say, their leadership will say, we are transitioning to hard power now. We are going to take military steps to damage the United States, to damage the interests of its allies, and we will threaten the rest of the world after we've done that damage. And you know, that's a real problem. We may not, because we may not prevail. And so I don't know where that point is, and that's really the essence of the question you're asking. How far?
Well, I was hoping to keep it not shooting, but what if, I'm looking up here how much of U.S. Treasuries they own. I mean, we're kind of broke. The new president, even though everybody thinks the world's great, has got some huge numbers in front of him. If all of a sudden the Chinese drop their investment here by $500 billion, either because they don't have it or they don't want to, it's probably because they don't have it, I got to believe these interest rates start to creep. And if they do, we got a problem here.
I think that's correct. Of course, that damages China as well.
Well, sure it does. They don't have it. I'm saying if we screw them, or not screw them. I mean, I don't like them. I'm with you on all that stuff. But if we economically damage them, it's one thing to beat up on your neighbor and to sneakily like screw up his corn crop. It's quite another if he owes you dough and you expect to get paid, right?
Well, that's right. And so we, you know, they've this was always,
or if he's an investor in your farm.
At least initially, back in the aughts, when we were aware of what they were doing, you saw a lot of our foreign policy analysts saying, it's given the merge or the financial connections between these two countries, it's almost impossible for them to engage in conflict directly, because it would be, you know, it's two scorpions in a bottle. It would be so damaging to the long term interests of these of both sides. That a direct conflict, where they were required to freeze assets and investments, is such that we neither side could tolerate it. So it makes no sense for the Chinese to start something, you know, take Taiwan or something like that, where they have the kind of vulnerability that is imposed by their ownership of our treasuries and investment in the economy, and the same thing for us, where so much of our manufacturing capability had ultimately been moved over there. The problem with that analysis is that was a bunch of people thinking like you, you know, thinking like Western trained economists who are looking, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years. Whereas the Chinese government, which is running the show there, is not looking at things that way. They're looking at 20, 30, 40 years, and they may be able to say to themselves, we will take the short-term economic mess, the you know, the loss of those treasuries and everything else, we will take that if we and we'll recover in 40 years in exchange for Taiwan. And we don't, our guys don't think that way. And we were attributing to them, I think, our world outlook. They don't look at it that way. And so their defense buildup has made it very clear, at least to our military people that are paying attention, the ones that aren't involved in DEI, that they have every intention of taking Taiwan in a military way, and every intent of expanding their influence over and controlling the Philippines and probably Japan and maybe Australia and Indonesia in a hard power kind of way. And now, you know, and their position is, even if we get into a conflict with the United States, we will, assuming it's short of nuclear, we will weather it. They won't. And I think that's the calculation.
Well, short of everybody shooting everybody, I guess you, I'll use the term, it seems to me, I mean, I'm thinking like every day since last week of the incredible conversation you and Carl had. regarding sourced parts from other places that are key to our military. And I tell you what, that conversation, maybe with me taken out of it, ought to be national force listening for everybody in any college everywhere.
I agree.
And if the idea of taking over Taiwan, if they influence them enough to put an embargo on the U.S., influenced either by a gun to their head or saying we're not going to put a gun to your head, how long do we last here, our manufacturing? Eventually, you know, we'll probably get it together, but eventually it could be a long time.
Yeah, good question. More importantly, let's. I mean, I've been reading some military wargaming kind of assessments. You know, that they decide it's worth it for them to basically, you know, sever our internet connection, shut off our internet capabilities, damage our SATCOM stuff. By the way, our friend Mr. Musk has rendered our vulnerability greatly reduced by his Starlink system.
I would agree.
In terms of comms and interconnectivity, the constellation of satellites that he's put up there makes it very difficult for an opponent to shut down our ability to talk to our forces. Or
where did he get these people? Did he get these people from NASA?
What people?
The people that are doing the stuff. I mean, the guy's not sitting there designing the rocket himself. I mean, where did he get these engineers?
Some of them came from NASA. A lot of them came out of MIT, Caltech, and the Jet Propulsion Lab. I mean, he's hired. I've got a good friend of mine whose kid was hired right out of college for SpaceX, and he's in his mid 30s. He's now running. You know, came up through the company when it started young. He's now running launch operations at Canaveral, and you know, as a 34-year-old, 35-year-old. He's in charge of all the launch operations.
Wow.
He runs that.
Have you ever been there?
Pardon me?
You ever been there, Canaveral?
Yep.
How cool is that? I mean, is it a bucket list place?
I was there for a space shuttle launch a few years ago, or about, 30 years ago now. Anyway, the point is that we don't know where the tipping point is for China in terms of economics. And they seem to be looking at this, as I said, from the perspective of 40, 50, 60 years down the road, and saying to themselves, yeah, we're thoroughly prepared to have short-term losses, short-term pain, short-term economic damage, if we will set ourselves up to be the world power that we think we should be in another 30 years.
How can you do that when you can't even feed yourself? It's like, how powerful
Tom,
is North Korea?
A lot of their investment overseas has been aimed at trying to deal with that problem. You know, that's why they're buying up land. They were buying up land here. They're buying up land in Canada. They're bribing officials in Canada. Half of the Canadian government was taking payments from foreign sources. They're buying up land in Africa for cultivation, run by Chinese companies.
I think that's just a way to get money out of there. More of a diversification and less of a.
Well, they did the Silk Road stuff. They want people in we did that here. I mean, there's we got a dash here pretty soon, but we did that here. The whole import export bank.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's that.
But I mean,
they're doing it on terms that are a little less positive.
We did some of that at Pullman. Like, if we were going to put up a refinery, if Pullman was going to design and help build a refinery, say in Saudi or someplace, or wherever it was, we financed it. But I don't think we ever lost money on those things, because they made money, obviously, by refining oil. But it gets you an inroad. It gets you your people maybe in a contract to fix it. But then again, it's really good relations. I don't know
The Chinese are not, based on what I saw when I was working in Italy, the Chinese are not interested in establishing good relations with these places. They're interested in taking them over.
Yeah, I'm saying I don't think we ever thought that, oh, by the way, if we ever had a problem, we could go in and steal the thing back. I mean,
no, but the Chinese look at it that way. I mean this is for the Chinese investment operations, this is a one-way street. You know, they throw money at something in order to, you know, provide infrastructure or support, but it's all done with China labor, with China money. The host companies, as I said, I saw this in Italy. There's a lot of resentment to it there too, as there should be. You know, they're not looking to, you know, raise all the boats with the idea that if we create a burgeoning economy in some, you know, awful place in Africa, it will ultimately benefit us down the road, because they will eventually stand on their own 2 feet. That's not the China model, and. You know, again, every step that a Chinese entity takes is aimed at supporting the goals of their national government. There is virtually nothing that I can think of, no investment, no project, no nothing that is aimed at sort of an overall general welfare help. It you know, as a side effect, it's all done in coordination with their government's ultimate goal. And they take a multi-generational view of this.
But it's history, well, it doesn't mean it'll happen again, but history has kind of shown that if you do that before when your economy's not in good shape. I mean, if you read economically what was going on in Germany before they invaded Poland and those places, they were broke. And they essentially started the invasion to steal money from other people. I think if they would have waited militarily, if they weren't broke, how can I say this? To launch a war because you're broke somehow or another doesn't usually come out and do well for the person who does that, even though it may take a while and cause anguish all around the rest of the world. I mean, you know, Hitler launched his thing at a time where the invasion was going to help them economically by stealing money from other people. Because they were broke on their own. Now, if China waits till they got nothing but debt and nobody's living anywhere, when you do something from a weak point, you can kill a hell of a lot of people, but generally you don't end up the winner, do you?
But they may take the view and say, you know, even Germany, even Japan, destroyed, devastated, whatever. You know, a generation later, we're back on the saddle. They may be taking that worldview.
Now the Bears got somebody else calling the plays. Why didn't we get that job? We could call plays.
Well, more importantly, we could probably call plays as well as the guy that was in there beforehand.
Do you see they also can the Bears had a run over here a second, but Dan will understand we're talking football. The Bears, you probably remember the name of this guy. This had to be 10, 15 years ago. The Bears picked a guard essentially off the scrap heap from some team that had salary cap problems. And the guy shows up here, and for 5 years he was a fairly underpaid, damn near all-pro, never missed a game, quality guard. And the Bears got the mentality that we can always get these offensive linemen that somebody else tosses. Well, they get this guy. And we were talking about him yesterday. $20 million. The guy's played 16 games. Has never, did he even go to a mini camp? Did he ever show up at practice? I mean, oh, I'm sure he showed up some, but the guy just never wanted to be here. And just, you know, this team's terrible. I'm not going to play if I got a hangnail. And yesterday they cut him, eating a $20 million. That's bizarre, isn't it?
It reflects. Again, I sort of point this out like I did with the Redskins. When the Redskins were terrible, when I was living in Washington, year after year after year, through coaches, through quarterbacks, through whatever, and I said, so you look, when you have a consistently bad outlook like this, you look at the one constant, and the one constant is the ownership and who the ownership puts in charge, and that's Chicago.
Well, you've got a family. Half of them probably don't even care about football. That's making $200 million a year or thereabouts. That's a real number, Lou. God.
Yeah.
That's a family. Yeah, saying, we're not talking saying, about.
Who do you point the finger at? You point the finger at the entity that's been in constant, you know, in a constant in the organization, and the constant in the organization is the ownership. Bad judgment on the part of the ownership, over and over and over again.
Well, they really haven't had a general manager that's any good since Finks, and who came after him, Jerry Vanese. Because I think they just don't let the guy do anything, or they always get somebody on the cheap or whatever it is.
Or they pick people that look like them or that sound like them or that sound good to them, and that's the end.
So this guy that they promoted to offensive coordinator from being the passing design coach or something?
Passing design coach.
I'm going to say, you can bet me on this, he's right now the bottom five paid offensive coordinators. He might be the bottom one.
Could be.
That's,
you think,
important.
They raised his salary?
Maybe, but not to somebody. Just, why would anybody want to be a coach here or a quarterback here?
I don't know why anybody would want to be a quarterback here. I'm absolutely convinced that Chicago is the place quarterbacks go to die.
Oh yeah, I don't know when it's. But in there,
by the way, you were talking about that kid being banged around because of the lousy offensive line play.
Yeah,
Jay Cutler is not, you know, a popular figure, but that kid has my admiration for the way he handled getting beaten up. And if you remember, he took more sacks and more hard hits over the course of his time in Chicago than anybody else, I think, in NFL history.
All right, think for a second. Do you think he got battered more than Harbaugh did? Remember when Harbaugh was here, how bad he got beat up?
Yeah, I do think he did. The only guy I can think of that got beat up more than Cutler was Archie Manning.
Yeah, oh, God. It was like a jailbreak every play.
Yeah.
And he could barely walk, right?
Yeah. Chicago just doesn't do a good job.
Hey, are you, after your show last week, I got an email from one of our lady listeners in Arizona. The ski resorts in Arizona are going to open.
Yeah, they had a huge dump of snow. That snowstorm that came through last week just dumped a tremendous amount of moisture into the Southwest.
Are you going this weekend or soon?
I won't be up this weekend. I've got too much work to do.
All right, bud. Well, you take care of yourself. As usual, good stuff. We'll see how this all plays out. Be interesting. By the way, keep us up to date on what's going on in Britain on this thing. I think we're not far away here from somebody at some level trying to gain control of what's going on in these colleges.
Oh, well, I absolutely agree. And I've been waiting for Congress to step in and say, look, here's how we're going to characterize athletes, and here's how we're going to characterize this money flow.
Did you
think right now, Tom, the Senate, the government's waiting to see which state colleges benefit, and the ones that don't will start screaming.
Well, I was listening somehow or another. Dan, I think, is on, but he can pony in if he wants. I was listening to the Georgia Ole Miss game on radio, right? So the radio guys are always a lot more insightful than the guys on TV. The guys on TV, I don't know what they do, but they were talking about some, not the feature running back, but one of the other guys was pretty damn good on Ole Miss. The poor kid, just getting bit was a stoplight, so I wasn't paying all that much attention, but somehow or another, a tornado hit his house when he was a baby or a toddler, and his grandparents and his mother and one of his, anyway, like five deaths, and he was the only one who survived. And he ended up being, you know, raised by somebody. But so that's a spectacular thing. The kid seems like a pretty good kid. But I don't think
it was when he was a baby.
He was older?
It was recently.
No. I thought it was when he was real young, but I could be wrong. But anyway, this is his fourth college. He went to some, I think he went to a, did he go to a junior college, and he went to Clemson and to a Division II. Now, how in God's name does anybody keep any kind of, are we even joking about going to class now? I'm not saying a kid isn't, or, you know, he could be an A student as far as I know, but how the hell do you keep any kind of academic stuff going if that's happening to you? Not to mention the fact you're on the phone all the time trying to figure out where your next move is. Are we just ready to say these guys don't even have to go to school?
March 25th, 2021.
Is what? When
That's when the tornado hit.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Could have sworn these guys said he was a baby, but then again, I wasn't listening. Does it even go through the admission process at this point, Lou?
Let's just say it's attenuated.
I love that word, attenuated. Hey, put that on. We got to use that at least once a morning now, Greg. Attenuated. I love that. Well, you always do something for us, buddy. Take care of yourself.
Yes, take care.
You want to go to a quick break or you want to write to Dan?
Whatever you guys want.
You're the producer. I think
I'm
we go right to Dan.
Here to serve the listeners.
Oh, God. He's here to serve Dan. Dan, you got a guy here serving you. What do you think? He's serving up breakfast? What's he serving here? We don't know what he's serving.
I don't know. It's good to have a fellow Greek.
Yeah. You guys are going to control the world. You know, we have a Greek client, and he's terrific.
Nose, big eyebrows.
He said something about Greeks are the best people in the world, but the problem is they can never get along, so they can never get anything done. He said they get along socially, but whenever they try and do something, all they do is argue.
Oh, business-wise, I don't know. That's why they all open their own businesses.
I guess. You think that's true, Greg?
Definitely.
Really? So the Irish can band together and the Greeks can't.
100%.
That is interesting. Well, I used to go to my Italian relatives in Columbus. I'd go. You go to like a Friday night thing and some. They actually had a club. It was the Abruzzi Club. It was all the people in Columbus that were from the province of Abruzzi, which is right across the boot from Rome. And these guys, you'd go and somebody'd cook and they'd have a great chow and the women would play some card games and all the guys were playing bocce ball. And the entire night was one argument after another. Nobody ever slugged anybody, but they must, on a Friday night, they just wanted to argue with people. must have got the adrenaline up or something. I don't know. You'd sit there, they're all arguing. Nobody knows what they're arguing about. They're all friends.
Yeah. And that could be a Monday morning too.
Yeah, it's like going to play basketball with your buddies and trying to kill each other, and then all of a sudden going out for a beer. You know, it's the same thing, I guess.
Right. Yeah. No. Exactly.
So, what do you make of what's going on here? I mean, I'm kind of surprised that gold's flying one way, but Bitcoin's going the other way. Some of the stocks are doing fine. The interest rates are starting to creep back up. Where is this the dollar? Why exactly is the dollar getting so strong? That I don't get. So explain all this to us.
Yeah, so I think some interesting things have happened over the past week. I barely remember the conversation from last Thursday, but over the past week, there's been quite a bit going on. We did have this initial run up post-election. We did have this run up in stocks, and it's the last few days, it's sort of leveled off. The news that's coming has been decent. I mean, the CPI number came in as expected yesterday, the inflation number. There were no surprises there. I think, you know, I'm in the middle of a conference, a two-day conference, and talking to the CEOs of quite a few companies from different industries and getting their perspective, which I always find to be the best perspective and the most reliable perspective, because they're the ones who we're seeing everything day to day. But in terms of the market movement over the past week, certainly there's this, you know, exuberance, and rightly so. And the reason that I think where this comes from, the bottom line is corporate taxes. So the concern about, well, at this point, the concern that there'd be any increase in corporate taxes is gone. The likelihood is that we could see another cut in corporate taxes. And that actually has a two-prong effect. One is it's going to help companies. It's certainly going to help the bottom line in any company, every company. And that will propel stock prices. But it also puts more money into the system, which is something that happened when Trump had, you know, during Trump's administration, when the taxes were cut, corporate taxes were cut from 35% all the way down to 21%. So I believe that's a big component of the market rally and also of what we're seeing in with interest rates as well. So while stocks are doing kind of what you expected, bonds are doing kind of what you expected, Chief. The especially on the long end, we're seeing this increase in rates. Some of it has to do with concern about some inflation going forward. Because of this, you know, this cut in corporate taxes, because of the money coming into the system, and some of it also has to do with, you know, and also the real rate. I think going up at the same time. We already have a pretty much definite quarter point rate cut coming in December. The December Fed meeting is the 17th and 18th, so we still have a few weeks of data coming in, but it's very likely we'll see the short end continue to come down, and that means short-term rates. So we're going to see, you know, probably another quarter point or 25 basis point cut. What I'm hearing from some of the CEOs at this conference, which I do think is very relevant, is the, you know, sort of the demand side and trying to understand how this is going to impact basic industries, industrial companies, and companies in different industries across the board. And for the most part, it's going to be very positive. One of the manufacturing companies that I was speaking to yesterday said this is a really strong sign with the new economy coming in, that we're going to have more emphasis on the U.S., more emphasis on U.S. manufacturing in particular, which has really lagged in recent years. So all that is helping to propel the market and to propel a good a good sense of momentum. I think longer term, we're still going to be faced with higher inflation and some other issues. I don't know how long that's going to be, but it's, you know, maybe 6 months into next year, we're going to start seeing some other issues that are more obvious than we're seeing right now today.
I don't. I wonder. On the my economic side is not all the numbers side; it's the behavioral side. I'm absolutely stunned with how much, not just the campaign, but for the last many years, some things have managed to make it through society to the point where people think that doing something that really benefits Tesla somehow benefits them.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah.
I don't know if you. Watch the Saturday. Did you watch the Saturday Night Live skit the other night?
I didn't see that, but I did see some, quite a bit on Musk recently, and the interview, if you will, yesterday, putting him in charge. I mean, I think Trump's exact words was, you know, somewhat putting him in charge, and that to me is a little bit scary, because he is, you know, his hands are in a number of different industries, his focus is, you know, in a number of different areas, his style of management is really quite different than I think the traditionally strong CEO style of management. You know, the whole concept of people being, you know, fired over, you know, or losing jobs or the uncertainty and all that. And to a certain degree, that is the environment that we've always been in, that, you know, you're working at will. You're not, you know, working with, you know, you're not, once you're in an organization, it doesn't mean you're going to be there forever. So there's, you know, I think that's reality, but what I think Musk takes it to another level. Now, some of the layoffs that we're likely to see, or some of the shifting, if you will, that we're likely to see on the labor front, will happen because of things like automation. We will have, you know, as we automate warehouses, as we automate more jobs, there will be some, there will be some layoffs. The question then becomes, who is going to be, you know, where is the corporate culture going to go with a lot of these organizations, and in particular with you know, we're talking about Tesla, we're talking about SpaceX, we're talking about some of that, those businesses now suddenly taking spotlight, where in general I don't think they've been in the spotlight, but not to the same degree as they will be today, or they were yesterday when he was speaking.
Well, when you say automate, and people get, well, I should not have grown up where I did, Dan, but I have a problem with a guy who got $9 billion through government largesse saying the government's being wasteful. Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
They shouldn't have given him the $9 billion.
I mean, no, absolutely.
But anyway, when you say automation, I mean, people have this view that, you know, you look at an auto plant, which obviously they do an unbelievable job with the automation, and they have people there, but when you're, and you know, and it's something that's happened over a long period of time, where you got a robot, you know, putting the bolt into the door where a guy used to have to do it, and so forth. And And he always puts a bolt in the same spot, the robot. He's never hung over, all those things. That part I get. But when you talk about, like, where my, in a lot of the metalworking places where, like, my nephew works, and I'm somewhat familiar with that from my Pullman days, if people need parts or they need a conveyor belt or they need something where they have their machinery, there's a constant breaking down of stuff that's right. Working 24/7. When you come in with, I need these five parts and I need them right away. Well, maybe there were people who used to have to do that on a lathe and something else, and it would take, you know, somebody really skilled a couple of days to do it. But still, now you might have a machine that can actually do it, but somebody still has to design it, find the metal, put the specifications in the new machine, and the machine will make you the... It's not like the thing walks in the front door and a human being never does it and walks out the back door. That doesn't happen. I mean, when you say automation, you're talking about bits and pieces of the process becoming more automated, but still, this stuff takes a lot of skill to get done. And the skill is not in the machine. The skill is in the person now maybe setting up the machine, but you still need somebody.
Right, and you also still need oversight once the machine is set up. You still need oversight, and you also need somebody to be making those changes, as you know, and technology is moves very quickly, so you still need somebody managing that process as technology gets updated. So yeah, no question about it. It's just there is, you know, there's been a shift in general, regardless of administration, towards more automation. Part of one of the challenges that I heard from a number of the CEOs, and it's been a challenge for a number of years, is finding those factory workers to come in and you know, take those jobs as baby boomers retire. There's still a need, and there will be a need, and there, you know, it's forcing companies to provide a better environment for employees to be competitive, to be able to attract people in whatever location they're in, and in most cases it's going to be smaller towns, smaller cities.
Well, one thing, it's sort of interesting, I don't know about the human mind and how it works or if it works, but it seems like I can't even have a cup of coffee or a beer without somebody opining on what Trump is going to do, and it's a positive thing for them, especially if they voted for him. And when I ask the question, so when did you talk to him? Well, what do you mean?
Yeah.
Well, you seem to be in his mind somehow. I haven't heard him say anything. Right. I haven't seen him say anything like that. But you obviously did. When did you talk to him? Well, what do you mean? Well, he's going to do this for my industry. He's going to lower corporate taxes and make things better. Do you work for a corporation? Well, no. So how's that going to make things? I mean, what? I mean, there's something about the Saturday Night Live thing. I was referring to as they get the black dude Che, or whatever his name is. Talking about how much money the market, the rich, well, not every, a lot of people are in the market, not just rich people, even though he said rich people, that they've made, you know, $60 billion in 2 days or something. And then he shows a guy a beard with a MAGA hat, a white guy with a beard and a flannel shirt saying, don't worry, yours is coming this week.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not so sure I'm on this gravy train, are you? I mean,
No, and I think that's a really good analogy, too, that's... It's probably. I mean, political promises, right? Promises that were made during the election, during the campaign, aren't necessarily going to be materialized. And if any of them do, they're not going to materialize in the way that they were spoken, or certainly more importantly, in the way that some of the people, including the guy in that skit, interpreted how they were going to be viewed. So that. You know, the trickle-down effect is, I think, important to understand. I mean, people in our industry understand it, especially people like me who have been analyzing companies and doing research on companies for almost 40 years and looking at management and how things happen. And it's, you know, generally going to take time for those things to happen and generally take time for it to have an impact on people personally. Unfortunately, I think in this recent election, a lot of the decisions were made on, you know, the votes came in from people who were thinking, just as you're saying, that there was an interpretation that this was going to be better on a day-to-day basis because inflation would come down, your cost of your everyday items and your food and your housing and all that would come down. And I don't see it like that at all. In fact, I see that the opposite could happen. There's certain areas where we have seen inflation come down, but there's still plenty of areas where we haven't, and especially housing, especially medical costs, especially food prices. So even, you know, there's less acceleration in the prices, but there's still high prices and they're still unaffordable. And until that starts happening, I'm not going to be a believer that what's coming ahead is going to necessarily be helpful for that. At least with the rhetoric that we're hearing is
and I don't think same. Either. I don't think either side. I think you and I are in agreement, which you're not supposed to do on radio. Even if we had a Fed chairman and the Congress and everybody participated, because you can't just spend more than your or tax less than you're bringing, whichever it is. If we managed our money in such a way going forward that inflation was, say, 1% a year or 1.5% a year, which I don't think these guys are ever going to come to that spot. But even if they did, there is this 40% bubble over a 3 or 4 year period that has the entire society different than it was 5 years ago. Neither side has any intention of addressing that. And they've told us that every which way but Sunday. They're not going to address that. So now we have to sit there and say, okay, now we have somebody with a nice job never coming close to getting a new car, never coming close to getting a house unless his parents give him money. And then hopefully the stock market stays up so his parents got some money to give him. But it's the idea, I mean, how the population, how, you know, how somebody, especially people that I talk to who aren't Musk and Tesla, for them to say he's going to cut corporate taxes, that's great. I sit here and go, okay, we are 40%, but we're taxing 60% of what we're spending, something like that, right? Right. So now,
yeah,
I'm gonna, you know, you don't want to insult people. What manner of moron thinks that if you cut taxes for one person, that somebody else is going to have to make that up? And if they do, who is it? And the people you and I know are usually the people that have to make it up for the other people. And it's getting tiring. I mean, I would raise the corporate tax rate to 30% instantly, and I would say dividends are deductible, so nobody has to pay twice. Which probably means that corporations maybe even pay less than they do now, but at least it's fairer, I think. And, you know, we don't want guys keeping massive amounts of money just because their excuse is they don't want to pay taxes twice. You don't need Warren Buffett with $90 bazillion not giving it to any of his people. You don't need Microsoft with, you know, how many $1 trillion in cash, what the hell they got. You don't need that just because they're hiding behind the two-tiered tax law. I think regular people could do better with that money than those guys sitting in the bank, just me.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I absolutely agree that in the there is, I think, a lot of misconception about how the process works. And I had some very intelligent clients, but they've been asking questions in terms of the impact. You know, if this happens, then what happens? If rates go up, what does that mean for my account? Because we have money in bonds. And again, I have to explain that with bonds, we're in short-term bonds, and you know, we are not impacted as anywhere near as much if rates go up as if we were in long-term or 30-year bonds. Going back to your original question, Chief, on the dollar rally and Bitcoin being up. Bitcoin, I'm not totally sure about. I do think that there was a kind of a move towards higher risk assets, if you will. There was initially there was a pop in small cap. Small caps were sold off the last couple of days. They are going to move more dramatically, as we say in our industry, with a higher beta, meaning that if there's movements in the overall stock market, like the S&P 500, that small caps will move more in either direction, whether it's up or down. And in this case, I think that has leveled off the last few days, but there was a nice rally there. Likewise, Bitcoin, that would be put in the category of riskier assets, riskier investment, more speculative investment. But that seems to keep going. The other that you mentioned is the dollar. The dollar rally, I think, comes in the general thought that the new administration is going to be good for the U.S. economy, good for U.S. companies. There's going to be more money coming into the U.S. because of that, less money going out because of the tariffs. So that I think with the thought with the new administration is that it will be good for the dollar. So to the extent that we manufacture more, that we make more, that we, you know, we do more for business here, that we focus more on the U.S., that's going to help us relative to the rest of the world, and that's going to help the dollar. So I think that trend is moving in the right direction in terms of the way the dollar is.
And Dan, I think you're stone cold right in the people's perception, but
yes.
Again, if you know, and I know you're much more incisive than the regular bump that I talk to. When I talk about bump, I talk about my buddies downstairs. when you say this administration, and by the way, I'm hoping for the best. I mean, as I would have if the other person would have won. I mean, because I have problems there too. So it's
right.
But when you say we have confidence that the next 4 years will be better for manufacturing. Okay, well, I might, being the ass that I can be, might say, okay, Dan, what exactly did Joe Biden do to restrain growth in the last 4 years that screwed up manufacturing that this guy is going to change? I don't think anybody can think of anything that Biden even did, that let alone negative. I mean, so I don't know where the big change is. It's not like somebody said you can't hire new people, and this guy's going to say you can. I mean, where is the change? I mean, I'm curious.
Yeah, I think bigger picture, I agree with you that a lot of these policies are, you know, that are coming from the administration, you know, or talk or you know, speculation. Don't really come to be. The one thing that I think the one bill that was supposed to be helping was the infrastructure bill, where we'd be putting more money into roads and bridges and other types
which they
of
did.
Infrastructure here that
which
would help
did.
Those companies.
Well, which they did, but was slow. Just on a general level, and here's one without an answer. And I'll tell you where we were in 2004. Total U.S. federal tax revenue, $1.9 trillion. Boy, those are good old days, huh? $1.96 trillion. Corporate taxes were $239 billion. So we're talking, right. What, 12.5%? Something like that?
Yeah.
Right, so fast forward to, hit the wrong button here, to today. And so today we are 2024. So we have a total federal tax revenue of $5 trillion, corporate of $479 billion. So we're down to 9.5% from 12.5%. I'm not lobbing.
Right.
Now, is that positive, negative? If we go to 7% or 6 or 0, is that positive? What are we gaining from that? I don't know. I mean, maybe it's better down here. But how do I know? All I know is they're paying less as a percentage. Now, do I want to go even less?
I know there wasn't supposed to be an answer to this, but I'm going to give them.
Hey, if you got one, feel free.
But I have one. Yeah. So I don't think it's good if the rate drops, because I think what that ends up happening is as I mentioned earlier, that puts more money into the system. There's more spending. There's more money to spend when the corporate tax rate drops. And the fact that you are right, and that's a point that I think a lot of people miss, that it's already there, it's already happening, it's already putting more money in the system, it's already causing inflation. I think there is a direct impact there when you have more money. But where I think I look at it as the greed comes in is the fact that it's also fueling the stock market. It's helping every single company, every single public company who has to pay taxes. So their tax rate has gone down. So how they reinvest that money, or how they spend that new money, if it's spent on you know, acquisitions or growing their business, or you know, if their CapEx is on machinery or whatever, however they're spending it, and they're putting it back into the economy, but that's also creating more inflation. So I see it as a negative if we continue to, you know,
well, if you
go from 9.5% down to 7% on you know, the percentage of taxes coming from corporations.
Well, if you look at of course, it's hard, Dan, to figure out who the regular Democrat, who the regular Republican is these days.
Yeah, I agree.
And I was a Democrat. I'm lost, and I know a lot of Republicans that feel lost too because they're moderates. Right. So, but here's the Republican mantra. If you go back to Saint Ronald Reagan, who wasn't a saint, was he cut the bejesus out of taxes for most of the wealthy, and he cut some of this stuff for other people. They totally misread how much that was going to do to the deficit, right? So the next year, they put through the biggest tax increase we ever had, which people forget. They only remember the decrease, they don't remember the increase. But most of the increase came in payroll taxes. So you essentially cut for one group and raised for another group. I will bet you a nice drink over at Ceres, maybe more than one, that somewhere in the next year we're going to see increases in payroll taxes to make up for the cut in corporate taxes. And I'm not so sure that's a trade that most people in this country want to make, but that's what they're going to end up with. And it'll be, I think you probably could. Something has to happen with the medical stuff. You're either going to have this administration taking on Big Pharma and those people. There's not a snowball's chance in hell of that happening because they all got their pockets lined with it. Maybe not Trump. And he maybe could do something like that, actually. I hope he does. If he ever calls me, I'll mention it to him, but I don't think that's going to happen. Somebody needs to cut this medical stuff has to change. Now, if you're not going to do that, the thing you're going to do is you're going to raise the Medicare piece. And you're going to raise everybody's stuff on their Social Security and the hospitalization they pay. And you're going to raise everybody's contribution to Medicaid and all that stuff. That piece of your payroll tax is going to go up. And Social Security is not that far apart, but we're going to see a percent raise in that because they're going to talk about cutting rates. That's what the Musk boys are going to do. We're going to cut Social Security, and people are going to be outraged. And the fallback position is going to be a raise in the Social Security tax. So what you're going to see is the corporate taxes down. And you're going to see the payroll tax for somebody who's got a 1099 is not going to be 15%. It's going to be 18 or 19, and that's the trade-off we're going to get. That's the Republican mantra,
right?
And I'm not. And most people, maybe they're all okay with it, but at least know what's going to happen and what they're doing. And I'm not saying that. Right now the payroll people think that people don't pay tax. Payroll taxes are almost as high as the income tax.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely, and that it's true for small businesses as well. I mean, it is one of those, it is a tax that I think a lot of people who don't have to pay it don't understand.
I'm not asking people to become, tax gurus, but in this country, Dan, you're more of a world traveler than me. Other countries don't do their crap like this. We have federal income tax is $5 trillion, state revenue is 2.4, and local is 1.3. So if you add those two together, state and local is almost as much as federal. Okay.
Right.
So if you see and people go, "Oh, look at Chicago, it's a mess," blah blah blah. We don't like Mayor Johnson, which, by the way, I don't, and it is a mess. Okay, so you're not going to get an argument on it. Well, this administration is going to cut back on the money that has been given to Illinois and Chicago. A lot of it was COVID, but a lot of it wasn't. So you're going to see, and already you're seeing it, that your local taxes are going to go up. And now you can be of the thing, you idiots elected a Democrat, you deserve to have it go up. Okay, fine, that's an ignorant argument, but go ahead, you can have it. And you also have the part about when you have inflation, you and I have talked about this, was it 6 years ago, Trump's gang put through the idea of, okay, if you're paying more than $10,000 in property taxes, you're from a Democratic state, and screw them, you should vote Republicans in, and that wouldn't happen. Okay, well, now we have a 40% inflation, and I'm going to say that 4 to 5 times as many people than 6 years ago are affected by that being only $10,000.
Absolutely.
Now, there's people in my neighborhood that happily vote Republican, that all of a sudden their taxes are more than 10 grand.
All right.
And now, 6 years ago, they probably weren't. Now, It's like silly putty, Dan. We have three places. Right. If you squeeze it out of one spot, you're going to pop it up somewhere else.
Absolutely. You know, I think that's a really good point. It's the, you know, again, it's sort of the naivety of not realizing that, you know, that I think the big picture, again, there's, you know, concern, you know, going back to the traditional Republican Party, concern about overspending or concern about spending, you know, like having this excess, or frankly, concern about having labor or people in positions in government who aren't doing much, whether it be government or corporate for that matter. One of the positive things, and this might just be a personal opinion more than, you know, well, actually, I think it is also an investment, you know, investment opinion, is that the slack that's in some of the systems, whether it be in the government or whether it be a corporation, is going to wind its way out. So in other words, what I'm talking about are those workers who've been working remotely, for example, or those government workers who were missing for 2 years during COVID that were working from home, or, you know, really weren't working much because this is, you know, this everything was shut down. So the trend, and I think this is a positive when I talk to CEOs, and it is to get people to come back in the office, to people to become more productive with work, to get rid of some of the slack, to get rid of those people who are, you know, working an hour a day from home and getting paid a very fat salary. That trend, I think, is probably going to benefit in this, you know, in the upcoming year, and it's going to continue to accelerate, and that's a good thing. That to me is more, that would be a more positive, that would have a much bigger impact itself than having to lower the tax rate or make any other changes. I think those managers of people, and I think the good ones that I've been talking to and the good ones that I've been talking to over the years that want to see more productivity from their workers, that want to kind of help shift the mindset back into, you know, hard work and getting ahead and providing a culture that rewards you for that, which we haven't seen as much recently, especially from the tech companies. So if we can get back there, I want to stay optimistic and say that would be a good place to go from the point of view of an employee, the point of view of the company benefiting from employees who were happy to come to work each day, and kind of getting back, I think, a better sense of communication in organizations internally, and a better sense of morale. And those would be the things that would be positive. We've already started that trend, and that trend hopefully will accelerate with the new administration. It doesn't have to be extreme. I think there's a way of shifting back from this, you know, COVID, work from home, you know, collect the money without working mentality to, okay, let's get back to what we're all about here in America, and that's hard work and you know, enjoying the benefits of helping, you know, contributing to the society and making a difference and helping your company grow and you know, make, you know, that sort of getting back to that mentality. I think we're kind of in the middle of these two extremes. We're in the extreme period we just came from, which was, you know, a lot of slack in the system, a lot of slack in the government, a lot of slack in corporations. And I think then we have the other extreme with the Elon Musks, who are, you know, cutting every single job, or even Trump for that matter, the whole concept of cutting jobs. So we need to be someplace in the middle, I think, to have a good equilibrium that's going to sustain our economy without having runaway inflation and without having runaway high unemployment or and I don't know how that happens, but I think that's where we're kind of in the middle there right now, and hopefully we continue to advance towards a better equilibrium.
Well, Dan, there is so much stuff to do. I look at, you know, my city, which, you know, I've loved and had a couple chances to get out of here, and I never took them. You know, this is my place.
Right.
And yet I see it. I mean, we have people in some of these neighborhoods that we're sending checks to, all right? And we have people that are not that many here as compared to other places. We got a lot of migrants. It looked to me like they're in the Home Depot looking for a job. Now, somehow or another, this is all costing people a lot of dough, okay? And that was clearly in the campaign. You're giving these people dough. Get them on a railroad car and get them the hell out of there. And That's the vision in most people's mind. Well, I look at the city. The city has all kinds of crap that needs to be done. If it's costing us all this money anyway to keep people that are on the dole or are on welfare or whatever, not all of them are capable of work, I get that. And we have all these people that supposedly cost us billions of dollars for the migrants. I see no money going to these guys. Why don't we get the dough out of the hands of the organizers and the other people? There are blocks and blocks and parks and places and people that need help. Let's pay people to go do all this stuff. We're spending the money anyway. If it's costing us $300 a day to house a migrant, let's pay the guy $300 and have him do something.
I think that's the solution. Having programs that are going to help get people to work, you know, get migrants to work, you know, provide programs that are going to do that, not just eliminate and deport. I think it's more about, you've got people who are, in most cases, are going to be healthy and of working age. You know, provide opportunities, because there's certainly plenty of opportunities. I think it starts out with those jobs that most people don't want, or that people, at least during the COVID years, decided they didn't want.
Dan, I was a janitor for 6 years. I was a janitor for 6 years. I wasn't there. There are blacks and blacks in the city that have 3 and 4 houses where people are living in, and the rest of them are just hanging there, backyards with crap in the backyard, old cars, old washing machines. Nobody would buy a piece of property on that block and say, let's build something. You know what? A team of 10, 12 people, 2, 3, 4 days, clean all that crap out of there.
Yes.
You know, get it all done. Maybe we can return some of this place to the tax rolls instead of being decrepit. There's a lot of old people that have stuff that needs to be done in their house and they can't even heat the damn place. Help some people. It's not like it's more money. It's just, instead of it being stolen along the way, hey, how about you guys that is allegedly costing $400 a day to have you here? Why don't we just pay you the $400? Let's go do something. I mean,
do something, right? I absolutely 100% agree, and that will help the system. I think hopefully we move in that direction. You know, hopefully there's focus in that direction, and it just doesn't get ignored like it has been for the last X number of years. I mean, that I think is a big part of the solution to what people refer to as economic issues and issues of immigration. I think that what you're suggesting, I think, is a great solution, and that's what needs to happen. And how it happens, I'm not sure. Hopefully it does happen, and hopefully at least there's some there's movement in the right direction there. Maybe we need to come in and run a consulting business to the city of Chicago, but to other places as well, right?
It's an attitude, Dan. If you're doing
it is. But I think that behavior, I think that attitude has to change, and I think it will change. It is changing a little bit. I know there's been some pushback from people who are seeing their neighbors not having to work, or their friends, you know, working remotely and getting paid, you know, more than we are. I think there has to be a shift in attitude, and that shift has begun. I think we're just in the early stages, and I don't know whether this administration is going to be the best for that or. But regardless, that I think is going to, that would be the, those would be some of the steps taken in the right direction to bring us back into a sense of equilibrium, and also to bring us back into a place that's not only safer, but more productive. You know, we're going back to the sense of productivity and, you know, the view that productivity is good and a day of hard work is good. It's, you know, it's contribution to society.
Yeah, but I don't see, if somebody has 2 and 3 and 4 kids, they're getting money for that. I mean, whether they should have the 2 or 3, 4 kids, whether it's the same, where the fathers are, or father, you know what? Walk down to the school at 11 o'clock. The kids are in school anyway. Help in the kitchen for 2 hours.
Yeah.
This is not abusive. This is. I'd want to go to something like that. I'm not going to sit on a sofa all day long. I mean, the attitude. I went and helped. By the way, I baked the cookies. The kids love the cookies. I did something right today. I used to clean classrooms. I was proud that I don't think anybody...
I hope you didn't use any nuts and or peanuts.
Oh, God. Oh, in those days. No, you know, in those days, nobody cared. Everybody... The peanut butter cookies these ladies made were spectacular.
Yeah, you can't do that anymore.
Can't do that anymore. You should have seen, Greg, we probably, you're in the restaurant business, you should have seen the blocks of cheese and peanut butter you used to get from government surplus.
Yeah, that's...
It's unreal. I mean, the block of cheese is, what, 25 pounds or something? It was, and you... But they used to get the peanut butter in a 55-gallon drum. You imagine that?
I remember, yeah.
And I tell you what... You'd have to make the call, which was better, the chocolate chip or the peanut butter. They were to die for. And I think it was 2 cents or something for a cookie, a big old cookie. But, you know, those ladies love doing that stuff.
Right. I mean, yeah, absolutely.
And I don't know. I'm thinking they were, well, there were no guys working in the kitchen in those days in the schools. You know, I'm not being sexist. That's what they were. I mean, and they were, you know what? One was nicer than the next. Kids had a great lunch, and I don't know where that all went. I mean, you know, I'm saying, crazy. But I mean, if you can't get down the block, well then you can't. But what do you think those? I don't think it was eight hours, Dan. I'll bet there was four or five.
Right, and they were for a lot of those people, especially the woman that you're talking about, because I remember that from high school, and they would come in after the school day started, and they would prepare the meals, and then they'd clean up afterwards. And it, you know, their kids were there at school, which some of them were, because I remember a couple of my buddies had mothers who would work in the cafeteria, and it was a win-win. You know, it was like they were making money, they were contributing, it was providing a service, and like you said, they always had a smile on their face. So that's a good example, I think, a simple example of what needs to happen to kind of get back. You know, but it is a shift of focus, and I think it's a shift that we might not be, you know, it might take a little longer to get back to that place than.
Well, what are we? So, in terms of bands, we have some people with a lot of cash. What do you think? Three more months, and then we'll see what the market does.
Yeah, that's where I was going to go next. I still think that short term makes sense. T-bill still makes sense, and just to remind. The listeners, that anytime interest rates go down, and we know we're going to have a cut in December. I mean, there's an 80% chance, and I think it's going to happen again. So we've had a couple of cuts. Our accounts that are heavily fixed income are all short-term focused, and they're doing extremely well because you benefit no matter how short-term your bond is, whether it's a two-month or a three-month T-bill. 1 month T-bill, 3 month T-bill, 6 month T-bill, you benefit when rates go down. So the price goes up. We actually trade that. We're not necessarily holding them all to maturity. But in the short run, I would say absolutely continue. You know, the short end looks attractive. I would stay away from anything 10 years and longer because of interest rate risk. If interest rates go up on the long end, which I think they're likely to continue to go higher, then the price of your bond is going to go down, and you're going to have to sit on that loss, if you will, unrealized loss. While you might continue to collect your interest, you're going to have lost money on the principal. So stay away from the long end, invest in the short end. Now, two other areas that we've been speaking about are corporate bonds and municipal bonds. Corporate bond spreads have tightened significantly in the last few weeks. And what that means is the premium that you get for the risk you take in buying a corporate bond rather than buying a treasury bond of the same maturity has diminished. So where you were getting 1.5% more on the yield over that 1 year or 2 year or 5 year corporate bond, you're now getting less than 1% more. So the benefit of holding that bond is, you know, the corporate bond over the treasury is declining. There's less benefit, and this is a very recent phenomenon. The trend has been towards what we call.
What do you suppose that is, Dan?
It's because of the same reason that the stock market is rallying. So what's happened is the corporate bond managers, which is what I've done my whole career, are looking at these bonds that might have been, you know, double B rated, or you know, they may not have the highest credit ratings, But we're looking at the short maturities and we're thinking, okay, this company has the cash to pay it. Well, now they have the additional benefit of the support of the financial markets in general, and there's less likelihood that we're going to see default. So there's already been low default risk and low expectation for defaults. That's even lower today. And so when default risk is the biggest risk when you're buying corporate bonds, default risk has diminished. And I think with the expectations that the new administration, with the new administration coming in, it even helps high yield bonds, because if you recall, and that's how I met Trump originally back in the late 80s when he was pitching a deal to us for one of the casinos, he was very much involved in that market from the point of view of the issuer, you know, the company that was looking for financing in the high yield. So he's going to be very supportive in general of taking care of those investors who are invested in high yield bonds. So that there's a lot of backing, if you will, from, you know, the expectation, at least. We're not sure if this will really happen, but there's a better likelihood that there's going to be more support for companies that are issuing debt that are, you know, don't have the best credit ratings or don't have the best balance sheet. So the default rates have come down. We have an administration that's likely to be supportive of companies that are distressed or near distressed.
What does that mean?
One name that what does that just mean? Filed what? Or is in the process of filing that I'm going to watch really closely is Spirit Airlines.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
They're an outlier, no question, in this environment. But it's going to be very interesting to see how this workout happens. In other words, where are they going to get support? Are there going to be potential buyers out there? You know, when you buy the corporate bonds of Spirit Airlines, does that mean they're going to zero? No. The answer is no. But there's a better chance of getting a better recovery or closer to 100% recovery in this environment today than there would have been 20 years ago.
Well, when everybody says everything is going to be, well, you hope everybody's right about this. How exactly, what has changed in the numbers in the last 10 days that gives this guy more flexibility than the old guy?
I think it's a perception again that we will have an administration that's going to be supportive of what I would refer to as the high yield market or companies that are highly leveraged, because that was really Trump's thing. That was, you know, his businesses were highly leveraged, and that's, you know, and then they went through the bankruptcy process. So there's I think perception that we're in a better place now than we might have been, you know, 15 days ago or whatever. But in general, the spreads have been coming in for the last few years. The corporate bonds have become less attractive. We've had a nice bump up in our performance because we hold a fair number of corporate bonds. We're now looking at selling some of them. Okay. The other thing is, as rates come down, we're now in the opposite environment. So we have a number of issuers who are refinancing. In fact, we have one very large municipal bond that we have across all of our taxable accounts, our clients in, that had a 7.5% coupon. Today, it's getting refinanced, and we're getting taken out at a nice premium. So,
oh, cool.
That's been a home run. So that's the advantage of continuing to stay in corporate bonds and municipal bonds. That as interest rates come down, especially on the short end, which is we're only investing on the short end, these companies are going to be reinvesting their refinancing, if you will, at lower rates. So you have a lot of positive factors, rates, you know, short rates at least coming down, a better environment for both, especially for corporate bonds, a better environment for the capital markets in general, more liquidity in the markets, more investors, more money in the markets. And the other source of capital in these environments are as we've spoken briefly before, would be the private equity investors, because there's not a whole lot out there for investors who are looking, you know, I used to manage a distressed hedge fund. There's not much to choose from. So what's going to happen is the investors are going to jump on any type of deal, like a Spirit Airlines deal, because it'll be one of the few options.
When it comes out of the bankruptcy, you're trying to figure out who's going to get what. I mean, stockholders look like they're getting nothing, as usual.
but they're in bankruptcy. There are people who can buy still. They can you can still buy the corporate debt. You can still negotiate.
Well, that's the game. You buy the corporate debt and you get a seat at the table and you end up with something.
Exactly. And now, but today I'd say because there are fewer deals out there to do that, that those companies that like a Spirit are probably going to get a lot more money today, and those bond investors are going to get paid off sooner with more money than they would have a decade ago or two decades ago.
Regarding something like Tesla, and this is not a shot at anybody, I've got it at about 92 times earnings, no dividend. Okay, now on the one hand you say, what are you, crazy? On the other hand you say, the guy's gotten a lot of stuff from government, works with government pretty well for him and maybe for government too. He's going to get even more. Or you just leave it alone. Which do you do?
It's tough. I mean, you have to kind of step back from, if you're looking just to make money as an investor, I could see this being a good opportunity. If you're looking at making an investment for the long term that you really believe in, that, you know, sustainable and all that, he's certainly in a good position. I mean, Musk is in a good position right now. He's got a lot of support. He's got a lot of, whether it's actually going to transpire or not, the expectation is that he'll continue to have that support going forward. So if you're in, you know, you're likely to at least start, you know, continue to go up and probably not as much downside. Where the downside could come, let's say middle of next year or at some point in the future, is just as it has with Tesla in the past. You're still in an industry that is developing. You're also being, the other side of the equation is the new administration is going to be more focused on fossil fuels and, you know, not necessarily getting rid of, gas cars, you know, cars that are still the old-fashioned cars, if you will. So there's going to be that that tension, if you will, between the two theories. You know, you've got the electric on one hand that's growing, and there is growing demand, but then you still have the other side of the equation, which is an administration that's supporting oil and gas. So,
well, Dan, we got a dash here in a second, but I don't know if you, Ron, yesterday I'll repeat it real quick. I get all these people. I don't know how I got on this Quora Digest thing, but there's people in there that, you know, that are pretty perceptive at some stuff. So somebody asked, what do you think of your Tesla car? And the guy who responded was from Europe. I mean, I don't know what country, I forgot, but he said on a yearly basis, his maintenance was way worse than in any other car. And now that it's 10 years old, they want 17,000 euros for a new battery.
Oh wow, yeah. Yeah, see, these are the stumbling blocks that with any type of new technology, you know, that people aren't aware of or they're not considering. They're just getting excited. So the excitement for Tesla I think was there. The excitement for EVs was there, but now the reality is hitting like this.
Well,
guy
he said you gotta, if he goes, I actually like the car, he said, but If I ever go there again, which I probably won't, I'm going to lease it for 3 years. And say,
yeah,
take it back. But
that
even
makes
then,
a lot more sense.
But then,
I have a hybrid now, and hybrids, I think, are a good alternative.
Well, except, I mean, if you've ever, we got a dash. I don't want to go into leasing calculations, but when you go to lease a car, there's three numbers, right, Dan? There's the purchase price, there's the price you think you can sell it, and there's a discount rate.
Yeah.
And between, if you lease it for 3 years, I used to be able to do the math in my head, and I can't anymore, but I probably could still figure it out. There's your lease rate. Well, if it turns out the price of the car is 80, at the end of 3 years, it's worth 20. You know,
right.
you're financing 60G for 3 years plus interest, so you can do the math. It's 20 grand plus the interest, so say 25 grand a year. That's one hell of a lease payment, right?
Yeah, so, it's not. I had one experience with the lease, and it absolutely was not worth it financially. It doesn't make sense.
I did two, and both of them worked out fine because I did a Chevy pick me up, which is the kind that everybody wanted. One was a GMC, one was a Chevy, and actually, they have a real high resale value.
Yeah,
didn't have. The advantage of a lease is you only have to pay the sales tax on the part you use. So in other words, if it was 30 when you bought it, and they thought the price was going to be in 4 years 22, you only have to pay sales tax on the 8.
If you knew that, it makes sense. I think if you're going to have it, you know, if you're only going to drive locally, or you're not going to put a lot of miles on, or you know, maybe you want to try out a new car, like you may have, like that makes sense. I have friends who do that are car fanatics. But where I think it can be an issue, unless it's a vehicle that has a high residual value, you know, after those 3 years, you have lost a fair amount of the.
I ended up buying it from them. And then reselling it because I took really good care of it. I bought it and then sold it for $2,000 more than I bought it from before.
See, that's a great story, and there are plenty of stories like that. But there are also, I think, some stories where there might be a new competitive vehicle that comes out during those 3 years that is now taking business away from the car that.
Well, in those days, say you got for 3 years, you got 36,000 miles, right? 12 a year.
Right.
Now, if you brought it in with more than that, like say 45, they were going to charge you 12 cents a mile over there.
Yes.
However, if you knew you were going to go over, you could buy the miles in the beginning for 8 cents a mile.
Okay.
So if you knew you were going to do 72,000 miles, for instance, you could buy 36,000 miles for 8 cents a mile. That's the best bargain ever, anywhere.
It's like prepaying the gas.
Yeah, that's the best bargain anywhere. I don't think they do that anymore. Audrey, you know, she deserves and has to have a nice car for real estate, right? Because you're taking people around and stuff.
Right.
But she has a lot of miles. And I said, hey, Aud, why don't you try and get one of these leases where you can buy the extra miles at that? And I don't think they do that anymore. That'd be perfect for her because she does like double the miles you're supposed to. Right, and if you can get them for 8 cents a mile, there's no way you can get 8 cents a mile on like a Cadillac ever. Right.
Yeah, that's very true.
But I don't know if they do that anymore.
Gone. Those days are gone though.
Hey, so when am I going to see you? We got to total up all our drink bets. By the way, who's winning? I think we're probably even.
Next week I'll be on. We have 2 weeks till Thanksgiving. I don't have any immediate plans to be in Chicago, but as soon as that happens, you will see me.
As soon as spring happens, not winter?
Spring. You know me too well.
Well, take care of yourself. We'll talk at you next week, bud. Right. Then week after that will be Thanksgiving. We'll talk to you next week. Right. SP Futures up 1, NASDAQ Futures on 16, not much going on. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.